So, welcome. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for coming. I see a few faces I have not seen or have not seen much. I'm Allison Wee. This is my last session out of 2 weeks worth of sessions here at Holden, and it's been a delight to have all of you here and conversing and visiting with me and thinking about all the issues of diversity that I have hoped to raise with us in this summer of the many-colored grace of God. It seems like a tack on, sort of forcing the issue to kind of stick nature into conversations about diversity to the extent that we usually think of diversity, like diversity training in the workplace, or, you know, diversity is usually about social categories and how we relate to one another as people. So I gave the title, I hope the provocative and yet rhetorical question type of title, is nature our neighbor? If we are to love our neighbors as ourselves, then if nature is our neighbor, then we have to think about our relationship to the natural world in certain kinds of ways. I know that obviously the Bible studies from this week have been focusing a lot on the problems of climate change and how much we need to attend to the finite natural resources of the world. I guess one of the ways in which I see this as sort of an analogous category that I wanted to talk about in keeping with these categories of gender and class and race and sexual orientation that we've taken up, is that we can fall, I think, into the same errors of thinking when we sort of value nature as a category that we sort of generically think that we value. Right? If we just think, oh, I love nature, but we don't necessarily have a very personal relationship to it, if we don't necessarily get close to it very often, if we don't think of it with a certain kind of respect and love that we might think to offer one another in our social circles, we might not get ourselves to a place to treat it in ways that we really need to, and in ways that we are called to be good stewards. So I thought I would bring to you three authors today. This is a topic, you know, there are tons of really great writers on the natural world who write about ethics, about philosophy, who write creative nonfiction, just celebrating sort of the richness of nature. There are ways that we can access celebrations of nature without getting out into it like we do here at Holden. Fortunately, we have these things called books. I think they'll still be called books when they're on Kindles. I'm not sure. Maybe they'll just be text, right? But this is one of the values I find in literature. We can always reach for a book and meet someone new, meet a new perspective, meet new information. We get caused to bring our imaginations into a place that is different than the one that we physically inhabit when we open up a book. And this is a great gift to us. We are finite material people. We can only get ourselves to certain places or to interact with certain people or spots. You know, I've talked a lot about the fact that we need to recognize how much of a privilege it is to be here at Holden Village. I think we all know that. That's sort of stating an obvious thing. But we all know how much work and effort and arrangements and logistics and time and money it takes to get up here, right? You don't just sort of say, oh, I've got a weekend free. Let's trot on up to that beautiful, beautiful, remarkable place that's Holden. It takes a lot of work for us to get here. So I make an assumption about all of us in the room that we share a certain kind of appreciation for, a desire for, a love of God's grandeur because we are drawn to come here. Or maybe we've heard of it, somebody else has enticed us to get up here, and then we get up here and we're blown away by how remarkable the natural world is. So in addition to all the things that we get to bring back into the rest of the world with us, by virtue of having spent time here, in addition to all the relationships and the talking and the storytelling and the sharing that we have, we do get to bring back with us some sense of what it is like to be here this close to wilderness, this close to the natural world, apart from all of the interferences and layers of human-made interventions, I guess, with the natural world. With my students at CLU, I teach an environmental literature class from time to time. And the first exercise that I have them do is to, over the first weekend, I meet them, I introduce myself, they go around with their names, and then I say, go find a place in the natural world as far away from human view or contact or impact as you can, you know, whatever that means for you. Some of them don't have transportation. There's a couple miles from campus, a really beautiful park called Wildwood Park. And usually half of them go there and down some trails, and you can get to places where you can't see, you at least can't see things, even if you're still hearing planes or hearing cars. But we live in an area near the Santa Monica Mountains. There's lots of lovely places that my students will end up finding and going. And I ask them to sit for an hour in this natural space. I tell them not to bring their phones with them. I tell them to bring pen and paper, and I give them models of what those things are so that they know, you know, oh, okay, that's what that tool is. But I invite them to go for an hour, and for the first hour to simply sit and ignore even the pencil and paper. And I tell them, just notice things. Just pay attention. And anything and everything that you notice is important. You know, notice the temperature of the air on your skin. You know, notice whether you can smell the flowers or some of the trees that are nearby. Notice whether there are little creatures that are running around. But also notice how you physically feel sitting there. You know, notice what happens to you to calm yourself and be in that space for a time. And notice where your mind goes. You know, it might go any number of places, but just notice these things. And then I tell them, you know, the second half of their hour, they should remain where they are, but start jotting a few notes so that when they come back from there, they have access to their memories a little bit better. So they come back with these sketch notes about what they were noticing. And it's really quite remarkable, the feedback I get from this one task. Most of my students have not done this. You know, they're just like, their minds are blown somehow by having an hour without their phone. And I thought I would read a few poems, talk a little bit about the nature ethic of the Romantic poets, and then talk to you about a 20th century American writer, Aldo Leopold, whom I hope a number of you know. I'm going to start with Wordsworth, in part because I said I would when I had to fill in my form. What am I going to talk about? There's any number of people. I'll do this. So here's a poem. It's a sonnet. I guess I have kind of a thing for sonnets. But it's called "The World is Too Much With Us." And Wordsworth writes this poem in about 1802. And he is in Western England, probably. You know, he's the one who spent a ton of time in the Lake District, right, walking around and writing about nature. And he is concerned about the rise of industrialism. He is looking down on a city that might have been Liverpool or might have been Manchester or something. And with the invention of the steam engine in 1750, there has been really swift and totally unregulated industrializing of these towns. And so, you know, it's a couple generations in to these towns starting to make factories that are burning coal and there's a span of time where some of these cities in England, social historians tell us that the air was just yellow. There's just this heavy burnt air that would just fester in cities. And, you know, living near LA, I can kind of relate to this. You know, you come over the pass and you look down and there's just this bowl of brown, you know, and you just think, that is not the color that air should be. I should not be able to see air, you know. So Wordsworth, I find, a very contemporary voice in some ways. It seems like an old-fashioned name. You probably read some poems of his in high school English classes or something. And my students are also always surprised to find out that some older writer has something to say to them, which is, of course, why I do what I do. But so this is the scene. The speaker, who is probably Wordsworth, lyric poem, is looking down on the damage of industrialism on this city, right? And here's the poem. The world is too much with us, late and soon, getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. Little we see in nature that is ours, we have given our hearts away, a sordid boon. This sea that lies before us, with its breast to the moon, the wind that will be howling at all hours, but is upgathered now like sleeping flowers. For this, for everything, we are out of tune. It moves us not. Great God, I'd rather be a pagan, suckled at a creed outworn. So might I, standing on this pleasant lea, have glimpses that would leave me less forlorn, catch sight of Proteus rising from the sea, or hear old Triton blow his wreathed horn. This poem, I bothered to memorize it a long time ago because I wanted to have it with me. I wanted to remember it and wanted to know it. And it speaks to me as a person from a Christian family, who is living in a world that feels as though people don't see God in nature, right? They see wood and diamonds and, you know, oil and all these things as stuff to use, resources, right? Instead of seeing there the heart of God and the gifts of God and something that belongs to us, that we belong to, right? There's a way in which industrialism, whether it's the 19th century kind or the 21st century kind, I guess, that separates us not just from nature but from ourselves. And if we don't take that seriously, you know, if we don't recognize that, if we don't get that, then we are going to be moving through the world as partial humans, you know, and it allows us to damage the very things that are life-giving to us. Wordsworth is a really interesting guy. He wrote a ton of poems. He wrote a very long autobiographical poem in blank verse called The Prelude, and it is on the growth of the poet's mind. And my students hate to read The Prelude. You know, it's just this long, because it's in blank verse, it has kind of this meditative, kind of ritualistic rhythm, but nothing rhymes, and it's just kind of like a talking at you on the page, but somehow it's hard to unravel the grammar because the students don't know any grammar. sad but true. They cannot, you know, figure out how to put a sentence together if a poet has moved around some of the parts of the sentence. And so things just make no sense to them. And then they don't look words up in the dictionary, even though that's online, right? You don't even have to have a book. www. Dot, you're right there. So this is why the work I do is painful but important. At any rate, one of the things that Wordsworth is certain of, and that he writes about a lot, is the fact that nature is not just something beautiful to appreciate. He's not just a tree hugger in some sense of, yay, the pretty nature, it makes me feel happy or something. He thinks a lot about how memories of time in nature can bring us back to ourselves even when we are not in that space. A lot of his poetry is about memory. He also writes about nature as being one of our greatest teachers. And his notion is that nature teaches us through beauty and fear. The beauty and the fear of nature are both great educators, as far as Wordsworth is concerned. And this is where the idea of the sublime comes in. The sublime is a term that I'm sure people in philosophy could talk about in much richer ways. But in literary fields, one of the things that matters about the sublime is that this refers to the raw, giant power of nature. Sublime scenes are crashing thunderstorms or avalanches or the expanse of the Alps that go as far as the eye can see when you get up there. They're the kinds of big beauty, big natural beauty that is actually dangerous, right? You know, we come up to Holden and you got to respect nature because nature doesn't sit around and pay attention to you as an individual. Right? If you're stupid and careless about nature, it'll take you out, and it won't care, right? You know, you need to not be hiking when the weather conditions are such that there are potential for avalanches or, you know, too bad for you. But for Wordsworth and the Romantics, this kind of dramatic power was really important to attend to. Right, really important in terms of how it gets us to respect what we encounter in the natural world, and that we are not the biggest thing or the most powerful thing. And so there's a way in which I think attention to the sublime can still be a really helpful factor in how we think about the natural world. And we've been seeing all around us, right, the floods, the droughts. This is dangerous stuff. And it should get our attention, and it should have some kind of impact on our hearts and minds about what we are doing. A lot of the Romantic poets had this idea about nature, that nature is where God resides and where we find God, and we find the peace of God that is in us. The Romantics really took seriously the fact that they were creators, and the idea of God as a creative being and themselves as literary creators, they really felt was an important relationship to value and to work with. And so this is part of what drives the writing of these poems also, that there's a way in which the poet, who Wordsworth would argue is not some special kind of person, the poet for Wordsworth is not an elite figure that's really different than everybody else who has some kind of, I don't know, some special muse that nobody else has access to. He thinks that writers are real regular people and should be writing to and for and on behalf of regular people. But he does believe that a poet has or should have a special sort of degree of sensitivity to relationships, to the world around them, etc. Aldo Leopold is, as I said, a 20th century writer. He was born in 1877, I think. Let me get that date right. He was born in 1887 in Burlington, Iowa. And he enrolled in the early 20th century in the Yale Forestry School, and this was the first graduate school of forestry in the United States. So he graduated with a master's in 1909, joined the U.S. Forest Service, and by 1924 was the associate director of the U.S. Forest Products Lab in Madison, Wisconsin, which was the principal research institution of the Forest Service at that time. So he's on sort of the cutting edge of 20th century forestry as a natural science of preservation and this movement of ecology that we are not sort of coming to as inventors of it, right? It's been around for a long time. A Sand County Almanac is a really seminal piece of his writing. Has anyone here read any parts of the Sand County Almanac? Oh, a few of you. It's really worth a read. It's a book that is divided into three parts. The first part is little, it's his naturalist self going into the world around where he lives, and it's divided by the months. And so each month there's a January episode, a February episode, and he's just going out and observing what he observes. You know, one month it's the hare and the mouse who are, you know, scuttling around, and he's thinking about the layers of the snow and how it's protecting the straw underneath. And, you know, he's thinking about his just immediate locale through both his appreciative kind of creative lens and his scientific lens. So they're really fun. They're kind of brief. The second section is called Sketches from Here and There. And these are kind of similar. They're nonfiction. They're little descriptors, but from different regions where he has traveled. And so, you know, there'll be the name of a town or the name of a county or something. And he writes about the area around there and its particular marsh or swamp and its particular histories. And he thinks back about sort of all the millennia of development that created a particular kind of bioregion. And then he watches as humans start interacting with those regions. And the last section of his book is a collection of four essays, in which he works out in a more academic and more sort of logical argument fashion his idea of a land ethic. And his notion of a land ethic is that we do not value the things that we do not relate to individually and love. And so we have to find ways of interacting with nature, each of us, particulars to particulars, like I was talking about last night, right? Not just kind of categorically thinking of nature as this thing, because the minute you think of it as a generic category, it becomes kind of meaningless, right? What is that? I love nature. So how am I going to help nature if it's an abstraction, right? If you're going to have any role, you have to dig your hands in somewhere. These two hands into some spot where there is something, some kind of need to attend to. So his essay on the land ethic became a really central piece in the 50s and 60s and into the 70s about sort of creating the environmental discourse that we now have today. And what I like best about it is his sense that we have to consider the land a part of our community, a member of our community. So I guess what I wanted to do with the remainder of discussion time, because that's really where the best stuff happens, you don't all want to just sit and listen to me, but I'm interested in hearing from all of us about what ways perhaps you know of or are working with about, you know, sort of changing in your communities, treating the natural environment around as a community member, or thinking out loud about what that might mean for you if you haven't thought about it in those particular terms before. And if we believe that we are to love our neighbor as ourselves, and we think about that in terms of people, what do we do if the land is a community member, right here with us, not something apart from us that we look at and that we think about, but a participant, you know, with needs and interests and stuff that we should attend to. Yeah.
I'm from Spokane, Washington, and we have an Indian Native American as our mayor. And over her 4 years now in office, she's up for re-election. She has fostered a sustainability task force. Spokane sits on top of a large aquifer, and Spokaneites use 200 gallons of water per day per person.
Wow.
Which is double anywhere else in the world.
Wow.
And it's a profligate use of water. Her task force and their recommendations, which my partner Mary was part of, were met with a lot of resistance and political resistance, to the point that they were accusing the folks on the task force of being part of a United Nations conspiracy to take over Spokane.
Wow.
This was.
You can see the temptation there, right? I mean.
Come on in. And there were.
Out of all the places.
There were 300 or 400 well-meaning people that participated in a year-long process, developed a lot of things other than just the water resource, mm-hmm, a lot of mm-hmm. other things. And it just meets a stone cold wall of resistance.
Yeah. Yeah. These are dilemmas that I swear somehow can be tackled, but trying to figure out how and what you do is tough. Yes, please.
We come from Michigan, and we live in this very beautiful, pristine area, northwest lower Michigan. And it's a special place for many, many people. And we got wind, excuse the pun, a year ago that wind turbines were starting to head there. Duke Energy was talking to landowners. And at first we were like, oh, that sounds great, wind. And then we found our very dear friends who live very close to a place where a wind turbine would be sited were strongly opposed to it. And I think as we drove across the country, we saw lots of wind turbines. And I'm sure that this debate is for everyone. But it's kind of interesting to think, it's also interesting to drive by Anaconda and see that stack and know that this is the size of towers. They're looking to place 130 of them in three small townships.
Yeah.
And so I'm quick to put yard signs in my yard, but this one I thought I need to be very quiet about this and listen. And one of the things that I think, you know, as a steward or is it, you know, I don't know. I just see things on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
Big corporations, and then I see blue skies on the drive out here. I was surprised to see it in Montana and North Dakota. It just looked like the same sky I'd see by Gary, Indiana.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah, these are tricky questions, you know. The more you pay attention to the details of what's going on, the more complicated it looks, right? I think this is one of our dilemmas, that there's not sort of, you know, immediate obvious answers. I mean, if there were, wouldn't things be happening really differently? You know, in spite of the one of the root causes being money and who is trying to make it, you know. But my mother grew up on a ranch in northern South Dakota, and she has an issue with wind turbines. She just grew up with a sense of landscape, you know, a sense of the land being a certain kind of thing. And my parents still live near St. Olaf College, and the college now has a wind turbine that is right across the highway from where we live. And so every time, you know, you come to or from home, it's now on the horizon. Moving or not moving or something, and she's all just kind of frustrated about it, you know, not that she's upset about cleaner energy or more or something like that. I guess you'd have to ask the birds if they think that it's cleaner. You know, I think there's a serious problem with damage to bird populations, but I guess one of the things I just end up thinking of is that change. You know, if we listen to these Bible studies and if we get on the bandwagon about how immediately and dramatically we need to make changes in our lives, we have to become people open to a range of what that means. You know, it's easy for any of us to have a nostalgia for our home, a nostalgia for our childhood, a nostalgia for what places looked like when we loved them best, which is not to say, you know, just get over yourselves and build wind turbines, but there will be changes that have to be a part of the future. And whether that is sort of realizing, well, the landscape will look different than it did forever. You know, we have this, I think, tension in our own minds. I would like for things to be different, and I would like to have a world where people were attending to these things. But as a human being, I am still very attached to the familiar and what I know. And it's hard to cross that line sometimes.
Yeah, my son loves to read Wendell Berry, and he kind of talks about the sense of place as well. And he's been living with us. He's a 23-year-old for this past year, and looked at my green backyard in the suburbia, Twin Cities. And he said, "Mom, you have to have a garden back here." And I've never gardened. We've lived here 26 years, and I work full time. My husband works more than full time, and there's just no way we can do it. But he tore up half of my backyard to get to the and put a garden in. And I was terrified, but he was there to help me. And it's his project, not mine. But I love walking into my backyard and picking my salad for that lunch or supper. And I've never experienced that before. So there are ways, even living in a suburbia or a city, where we can, take a little more control, and it's all organic, and we know it's healthy, and we're composting, and he's just transformed our lives, but he's doing the weeding, not me. So his first year, he goes, "I'm going to train you, Mom, and then you get to do it for the rest of your life." I love it that our younger generation is pulling, at least my generation and me, and back into an understanding. My grandma did all this stuff, but not my mom, and not me. I don't know how I can, and he's going to teach me what I can this fall. I'm terrified of learning that, but even a while.
Yeah. Well, there are resources everywhere that we could avail ourselves of if we think of it and cause ourselves to do it. And you do kind of have to buck yourself up to, my rituals have to change, right? You don't, nothing about your day looks the same when you're living with that as one of your main food sources, the composting in particular, But we get used to that here, and then we go back and just kind of slip back into our sticking stuff in trash cans. I saw this hand from a while ago. I see a couple more. Yep.
We're lucky enough to live in a university town, and the university has taken it upon themselves to make sure that all of their events on the university campus create no garbage. Everything is either compostable or recyclable, and the community now has adopted that. Since I've lived in the community almost 20 years, and it was always recycling of everything. Paper, cans, plastic, that was always recyclable, but there was still a little bit of garbage. And now the community itself is extremely conscious of it, even the children, and I think that's where we need to go.
Yeah.
Just curious if you could speak to a little bit. It seems to me that there's a tension between respecting nature as your neighbor, and then sort of technological progress, scientific advancement, applied scientific advancement, because that, to me, is the mastery of nature, according to at least early scientists like Bacon and things like that. That actually the goal is to master nature with sort of technological advancement, and yet using that to sustain nature as our neighbor, it just seems like there's a rough tension there.
Yeah, well, I suppose you'd have to look at outcomes as, one place to look. Is our use of technology, we know a ton more than people used to, it's true. And, my sense of technology, I waffle a little bit, but, my general assumption is that technology, like art, like a lot of things, is something that intrinsically is neutral, morally neutral. And what makes it so is how we use it, to what end do we put it. So, I don't necessarily in my own life think about promoting going back to a lifestyle of 100 years ago or something. But I have trouble with that word mastery. What exactly you are mastering. If you're mastering skills, that's one thing, but mastery of the earth makes me nervous as a phrase, and it seems as a problematic interpretation of the word stewardship. But, it certainly seems plausible that science is going to be one of the ways that helps us redo what we are doing with our natural resources. You know, it's not going to be sort of eschewing science that's going to get us there at this point. It's true that we still do need jobs and have a lot of knowledge, but it's the application and end, I guess, that seems most important. I saw this hand a while ago.
Sure. I do, for me, I think part of the answer, part of our hope is definitely educating our children and involving them in this. I live in Seattle and have the opportunity to work with Boys and Girls Clubs, and we have, for the most part, they're urban settings. And so we're to the garden coming. We're building gardens at all the clubs, and the kids are involved in gardening, many of them for the first time. And then we're also taking that, the next step, and having teaching them about, you know, nutrition, and they're prepared, taking the garden and using those to cook meals. And we also are building green buildings, but educating the kids about collecting water and using that to irrigate and choice of building materials, and they can tell you about impervious surfaces. And so it's not the only answer, but I think as we look at the next generation, that they have to be on board and they have to own this, and it has to be part of their view.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that was important to me about Holden, I lived here for half a year when I was 10, and living in a self-sustaining community that is as small as this, you know, and you participate in everything from chopping the wood that warms the chalets to being on Garbo, where you watch, you know, the mound of stuff that comes in and you sift through it. Everything passes through your very hands, right? Everything that is disposable, and then it goes here, it goes here, it goes here, and you ride on the truck up to the sort of, you know, here's the landfill stuff that nothing can be done with, and you look at the amounts of that, you know. Being able to see the system in a way that Holden allows you to do, you know, from start to finish. Here's the hydro, you know, here are the numbers of units of energy we're using. You know, we can measure and see all of that right here in a way that you can't out elsewhere. You know, the systems are too big, you know. Lord knows who drives the garbage truck or where it goes, you know, or what is happening with these things. And I think it's that anonymity that makes it so much easier to not care. Again, it's that sort of, it dissolves into an abstraction and you can't figure out how to attend to it. But yeah, you know, bringing our kids into processes and helping them see systems instead of just goods, I think is really important. Yes, you. I'm trying to get hands kind of in order, so
okay.
I see where they are. We've still got lots of time.
My wife, we live in Portland, Oregon, and she had driven by, it was like a billboard, but it was a picture of a pelican wrapped up in plastic to the point that it couldn't move. And I had seen it then, too. It's just gets you, you know. And so we decided to start recycling plastic bags, which is not easy. And then the city of Portland passed a ban on plastic bags.
Yeah. Wow.
So I thought that was great, and it wasn't easy.
Yeah. What kinds of arguments do you recall? Is there anything you can point to that sort of led to the success of that vote? It's Portland. Yeah.
I think it's just, do you know? That's my wife.
No.
She knows
that.
Okay. I would guess this about, they were hammering home the indestructibility of it.
It gets out to the ocean and creates this giant
The mass of garbage in the ocean is terrifying, right? Has anyone seen the satellite images of the mass of garbage in the ocean that's bigger than Texas? I mean, now that we have like Google Maps and satellite stuff, you know, you can zoom in, you know, and so the visibility that technology allows us of what we're doing is also a useful kind of thing. You know, we should be terrified of that garbage.
One of our columnists says, prove to me that a plastic bag from Davis gets into the ocean. We're too far away. He says, therefore, we don't.
We're 100 miles.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good one. Yeah.
And
you just click and print out something, and you know, you think it would not be hard to prove anymore. Yeah, in the back.
Well,
there?
I think it's interesting to talk about kids because kids, you know, to a certain age, people of a certain age, are pretty intuitive about it. When I was 10 years old, we lived at Henderson Bay over the Olympic Peninsula, and I stood on the beach and watched them capture baby killer whales, and I knew it was wrong. I mean, even though they're beautiful and they're going to the zoo and everybody can see them, intuitively knew that it was wrong. And then for, you know, 40 years later, all this stuff came out, and people finally said, oh, this isn't a good thing. But I think if we catch the kids before some of these destructive things become part of their lives and part of making their lives easier, I mean, oh, cool, so now they're in the zoo, and I can just go to the zoo and see them, or,
yeah,
or whatever, instead of seeing them in the world where they're supposed to be seen.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's really important, but I think kids, you know, to a certain age, they understand it better than we get so used to having conveniences that that's more important to us than doing the extra work.
Mm-hmm. We're really good at being lazy and this is one of the weird things about humanity. We acclimate and then we just kind of ride along. And human beings tend not to like to change. I mean, this is a big fundamental part of the problem we're in. We have to change. And yet, convincing any given person of the change that is required, you know, there's resistance in, you know, I think a lot of us, if we're honest with ourselves. That's hard. And you're aware, of course, we're going to be accused of indoctrination, right? We you use the word, we got to catch the kids and, you know, make them know certain things. But, you know, yes, we need to do that. You know, kids, I agree with you that there's a certain intuition there in kids, but there's also like the Lord of the Flies, right? You know, we also need to model for kids because kids can also be as cruel as well as good as humanity has to offer.
It's interesting because I could hear the mother whales crying and I could hear them. And my parents,
oh my God. Oh my God.
I could hear it. It was so clear to me, and it was so obviously wrong to me at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Well, those are important stories to tell over and over.
Because
yeah.
You don't see them out there now. I don't think they even know any way they're now.
Yeah, we don't know what's next.
I was just wondering, like, is a sustainable society possible with such a mobile society? Can, like, in as much as, like, can you, like, really learn to, like, love and care for, like, a place if, like, you're kind of, like, by economic necessity, kind of, like, forced to move from it and, like, able to move from it with all of, like, the cheap gas and cheap coal, or mm-hmm. would this only, like, happen when, like, you know, the last car is out of gas and the last coal plant, like, burns its last bit of coal?
Yeah. Well, it's an excellent point. We've had the freedom to move around because of the, you know, falsely cheap gas that we have been sold in this country for several decades. But I don't know, you know, we are in this terrible economic climate where a ton of people aren't employed, and so yeah, there is this demand upon us, I think, to go where the jobs are. I would like to think there we still have a little bit of agency in what kinds of jobs we choose and where we choose to live in relationship to them. You know, in LA, the city is so big and, you know, so much of a car culture, and there's nothing in the way of public transportation that's worth anything. And so everyone, the sort of assumption is, oh, if you drive 2 hours for your job, everybody does it, you know. So everyone sits on those freeways and inhales all the carcinogens that, you know, make the cancer in the rats and lead to road rage and all that good stuff. But that is an attitude that has evolved somehow, and one can live there and not buy it. You know, one can live there and say, well, here's where my job is, and I'm gonna get as close to it as I can, or I'm just gonna make sure I carpool, or something, you know. But, you know, I understand what you're saying. We have to, I mean, we have been spread out now. You know, all of our families probably are all across the country, and Nobody likes the idea of somehow just minimizing visits to family. We don't live in these little villages anymore that just kind of have all your family and friends in them. Well, there are movements that are population density movements. When I lived in Minneapolis, which was about 10 years ago now, there was a cluster of people in South Minneapolis who were very intent on increasing population density in certain areas and decreasing the cars that were there. And I was just working in a coffee shop. I didn't go to those meetings, so I can't really tell you about how they were working. But, you know, certainly there are a lot of people in urban environments unhappy with, unsatisfied with the sort of lack of concern about the ways that the environment, you know, the economic environment is causing them to live, who are trying to be really intentional about other ways of doing it, ways of getting off that grid a little bit. But you need a village to do it, you know. It's really hard for one of us just to say, I'm going to change how I do things, because we are all sucked into this web of how things work. And I think it's important to find other like-minded people and figure out how can we, you know, share food, get, you know, make one set of trips for the grocery, or, you know, get to know your neighbors instead of just sticking with the friends that are on Facebook who live a long way away. But, you know, I think Facebook and our phone technologies cause us to, you know, all the rhetoric is that, oh, be more connected to your world, right? But, you know, I remember the difference between going to grad school on the public bus when I didn't have a cell phone, and I would ride on the public bus through these parts of town that I didn't live in, and I ended up having the craziest and also most interesting conversations with people who would sit down next to me for the ride, who are people I wouldn't have encountered in my little walks of life. And I was really grateful for, you know, them as individuals, for the laugh of the day, or, you know, getting to know someone for a moment, and just the reminder that people's lives are so varied and different than mine and less privileged than mine. But, you know, if you get on a public bus now, everyone's on their phones. Right? Nobody's talking to the person next to them. You don't have to anymore. And so, you know, those of us privileged enough to afford a giant cell phone bill and plan and all that stuff, which still isn't everybody, you know, we think we're connecting, but we're also isolating ourselves. And I still think, you know, Holden is a place that can remind us how important the people sitting in the room with us are. Soren Kierkegaard, whom many of you might know, is a Danish philosopher from the 19th century, and his idea of Christianity was the importance of serving your neighbor. We've all heard this, right? You're smiling, you know the text. The question is, who is your neighbor? The first person you encounter when you leave your door, that's your neighbor. Not everyone's my neighbor. I have this conversation with students in class, you know, and they're like, oh, that means everyone's my neighbor. No, it's not the everyone version of your neighbor. It is the person that you encounter as you step out your door. And serving your neighbor and loving that neighbor is how you take on the Christian commandment to love the neighbor. Now, not everyone follows Kierkegaard, and this is a particular translation, but it feels Holden-like to me, and it feels in this, you know, think globally, act locally. You know, I think it is a sentiment that we really need to pay attention to. Yes?
My hand, first one up in response to the concern about the wind farm and weather.
Oh, uh-huh.
To say, and then my thought has been fed by what I strongly identify with when you talk about our laziness, our desire to not make waves, something. In my wife's family in southwestern Minnesota 20 years ago, against an effort by Northern States Power to locate a massive coal-fired electric generator, they succeeded in stopping it by working at the science, by demonstrating and proving, first, that there was community resistance, and secondly, that the science was wrong. So my comment is intended to say, Amy looked at me with a funny look, so not that the science was wrong, but that the through this new generation capacity was really patently pretty transparent. But it took the work of people who were educated and willing to fight it and go around and talk to neighbors. And so I'm just wanting to say, it's very complex. I know people in North Dakota, which is where I'm from, that are delighted to have the wind towers there, because every one of them pays an annual lease for the use of that land. That exceeds by far any income they could have gotten per acre of any other use for that land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the crops. Who needs food?
And so economic opportunity and jobs and all. I mean, it's all there. So you can't just flatly say we don't want them here because it's not in my backyard. It's not going to get us anywhere in the neighborliness.
Yeah.
But so a number of variety of comments just floating as we work our way through this conversation.
Yeah, thank you.
I want to say one more thing.
Sure.
Just north of where Interstate 94 and 90 separate, and 94 goes north to Eau Claire, and 90 goes over to La Crosse, the first rest stop north of that interchange on Highway 94, it contains information about Aldo Leopold.
Oh.
That's the San County.
Oh, that's San County. That's excellent. Some of you might be nearby.
If you ever have time to drive that way, stop in. That's what this encouraged me to pick up the book.
Yeah. It really is a great book. I mean, I am at heart the English professor that I am, and I really think that literature can be a really powerful tool in motivating us, in educating us. You know, Leopold talks a lot about the fact that we need more information. You know, he's a scientist. He knows that we need to understand how these ecosystems and the biota work. You know, we need to understand that in order to not monkey with it in ways that will be damaging. But his interest is combined in such a wonderful way with sort of the beauty of language and its ability to sort of evoke the power and the beauty of the land. I think that nature writers, you know, the people whose names, like a Mary Oliver, poet, like Annie Dillard, you know, there are a lot of people who are just known for their keen observation and their way of crafting language to help us see in our mind's eye what they're looking at and appreciate what they're looking at. That's a great gift, you know. I don't know how to look at the natural world in the way that some people know how to do it. And so through literature and through poets who can help us feel what they are seeing and feeling, I think is really important. It's a great, you know, when we're feeling lazy or, you know, sort of overwhelmed by the mess of it all, you know, I think sometimes a text can help give us that courage. And I think that's really important. And it's not just nice. It's not just that poetry is nice and it's pleasant and it, you know, is kind of cool. It works on us in a different way than scientific essays work, right? There's data that we need to know, and thank God for all the scientists who write scientific essays. But a poem is going to function differently on us. And I think I'm going to use that segue. I know there are a couple people with a couple comments to make, and we still have a few minutes, but I'm going to read the poem that I had intended as our closing poem, because I'm proselytizing about poetry right now, right? It's the one right in front of me. It's here. Mary Oliver again, who
you should... Professional Order of English Majors?
Yes, something like that. Mary Oliver won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 1983 for American Primitive, and she won the National Book Award in 1992 for her new and selected poems. She is a person of great stature in the literary world, and she's still alive. She lives on the coast, but I think she's getting elderly now. But I read two poems. Because I have to. First one, morning poem, still morning. Every morning the world is created. Under the orange sticks of the sun, the heaped ashes of the night turn into leaves again and fasten themselves to the high branches. And the ponds appear like black cloth on which are painted hands. A of summer lilies. If it is your nature to be happy, you will swim away along the soft trails for hours, your imagination alighting everywhere. And if your spirit carries within it the thorn that is heavier than lead, if it's all you can do to keep on trudging, there is still somewhere deep within you a beast shouting that the earth is exactly what it wanted. Each pond with its blazing lilies is a prayer heard and answered lavishly every morning. Whether or not you have ever dared to be happy, whether or not you have ever dared to pray. And then some questions you might ask. Is the soul solid like iron? Or is it tender and breakable like the wings of a moth in the beak of an owl? Who has it and who doesn't? I keep looking around me. The face of the moose is as sad as the face of Jesus. The swan opens her white wings slowly. In the fall, the black bear carries leaves into the darkness. One question leads to another. Does the soul have a shape, like an iceberg, like the eye of a hummingbird? Does it have one lung, like the snake and the scallop? Why should I have it, and not the anteater who loves her children? Why should I have it, and not the camel? Come to think of it, what about the maple trees? What about the blue iris? What about all the little stones sitting alone in the moonlight? What about roses and lemons and their shining leaves? What about the grass? Some questions you might ask. We are at time. I know I missed a few comments. Do you want a couple hands in the back still?
I'm just going to give an example of indoctrination of children.
Ah, okay. I think we should hear that.
About a month ago, I'm from Portland as well. About a month ago, I took my 8-year-old to a class to make a worm bit, offered by a state park near our house. And we walked through the forest, and we got a little lesson about worms and also about moles. And I learned that moles actually keep the worm population down, which is very important. And then we went and we created a worm bit. And it was a really, I would recommend it to an activity to do with children, because we feed our worms our freeze scraps and they multiply and create really valuable, you know, compost.
Cool, thanks.
Yes. A writer that has made a difference in the way I see nature is David James Duncan.
Mm.
The River Why was the first book I read by him. He's a, I think, Northwest writer. At least he grew up in the Northwest. And then the other one that had quite an impact was My Story as Told by Water. And it's really his faith through the eyes of water in nature.
Huh.
So he's worth reading.
Yeah.
Not poet, you know. But
sure.
Poetic language.
Uh-huh, yeah. Well, anyone who can get you to see things a little bit differently,
yeah,
and make an impact is worth reading. So, thanks for that. Yes? Final word?
We may have one last comment. Just a gift to those of you that have to drive through North Dakota to get back to your pleasure, please. And I've been sitting here, I haven't been with Senior Memon, and I can't come up with the name of the author right now, from Lemon, South Dakota, prairie writer. May come to me yet, but she said.
Kathleen Norris.
Yes, Kathleen Norris, thank you.
Yeah, when sounds
you,
like.
When you live where you can almost literally sense the curvature of the earth, far from feeling like you're on the edge of nowhere, you feel like you're in the center of everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so think of that when you go to North Dakota.
Nice.
Which is the center of the earth.
Well, thank you very much.